Singai Las. In Haida, that means good morning. It's a pleasure to see you. I'm going to, how many of you are familiar with smudging? Just about everybody. So I'm going to use a little sage this morning across the auditorium. Sage is one of the four medicines that have pretty well become universal throughout Canada. And sweetgrass, tobacco, and cedar are the other three. Each has a different property in the culture, in the traditions. Sage is a purifying herb, and I will begin with a sage smudge and have a few words and a short prayer. I'll start with that. First, I'd like to acknowledge that we are on unceded Algonquin territory to this day, which means a lot to me because we Haida, our islands off the west coast of British Columbia, are also unceded territory. And it's good to see the Canadian society is beginning to address that. And I'm very, very happy for that. There's a local story, and I hear that you're going to hear more about it as time goes on, and it has spread throughout the region, and now many of its qualities are throughout Canada. Over there, the seven grandfather teachings. The Algonquin story, in short order, because I'm not Algonquin, it's not my story. I'll tell a short version. That the Creator sent a young man throughout the land to look for the qualities of life that were lacking and needed among the people. And he was given by seven grandfathers the following teachings. They are love, bravery, truth, respect, humility, wisdom, and honesty. Those are the teachings of the seven grandfathers, which are so important to the local culture and other cultures throughout the region. It's also important for us to realize that the teaching is highly sophisticated, because the elders teach that you cannot have one of those without the others. If you remove any one of them, wisdom, love loses, everything is tied together, everything is one, everything is related. So I'm happy to see, I'm joyful to see a conference which is dedicated to ethics, because for us as Indigenous people, ethics in other forms and other words are the teachings of the elders and the knowledge keepers, which is a good way to start the day. So in acknowledging that this is unceded Algonquin territory, I will pray a short prayer in the Algonquin language. Miigwech ajemnado. Kinagego Gamishian Miigwech. Creator, thank you for being here with us and for all you have done for us. Thank you. Creator, make this a conference in which our minds and hearts are open to one another and we become as one. And we pursue those things which bring people together and bring healing. And we follow those eight teachings of the seven grandfathers. The young man, after he received the teaching, by the times he'd received the teachings from the seven grandfathers, had become an elder, an old man. And so those teachings are also called the teachings of the first elder. Our elders' teachings are crucial to us. They hold, they bring us, they connect us with the past through the present. They teach what is necessary and essential to our young people. We pray that our young people follow those teachings because it's so important. We're in a time of reconciliation and healing, and we need those virtues among all of us, among all people. And for Indigenous people, it's a crucial matter. So Creator, be with us and guide us through the day and keep us and protect us. Protect our minds and open our hearts to one another. Miigwech, Salana and Haida, Miigwech, Hawa and Haida, thank you.
Thank you again for joining us today. Merci à tout le monde d'être venu. We're going to start very, very quickly because one of our first three panelists has to leave before 10 o'clock. And so I'm going to keep more administrative announcements for later. Seulement pour vous dire que les présentations sont dans la langue de préférence de la personne. Mais comme vous voyez, il y a des informations dans les deux langues. And if you want, during the question and answer, to make a comment or ask a question in French, ce sera très facile d'utiliser l'autre langue à chaque fois. Donc, I'd like to invite Jim Mitchell to start off, and he and Ralph Heinzman and Judith Moses are going to be our first presenters.
Good morning, everyone. Bonjour, tout le monde. Bob said, my name is Jim Mitchell. It's my pleasure, and in fact, I really want to say it's an honor to be here this morning, chairing this panel for at least for the next 45 minutes or so. It's an honor because I, like many of you, or at least some of you, knew John Tate. The man whose work and whose example is the focus of today's conference. And I'm sure that all of the good things that will be said today about John Tate, as you know, are true. He was a remarkable public servant, and he was an inspiration to everybody that worked with him and who knew him. The second reason I'm very pleased to be here is because I am a longtime friend and admirer of the two people on this panel this morning, Ralph Heinzman and Judith Moses. Judith and I were colleagues in the Machinery of Government Unit in PCO in the mid-80s, I suppose. Judith was one of the first people I met when I got there. She's a remarkable public servant, someone who has served in senior jobs at the federal level and the provincial level. She's worked in policy, she's worked on programs, she's worked in central agencies, and what's most important about Judith Moses is that she has always been a thinker. She's someone who cares deeply about difficult issues and values and about what lies beneath the surface, you might say. So it's wonderful that we have Judith here this morning up from Toronto. I have known and admired Ralph for almost the same length of time. I think I met Ralph just a couple of years after I met Judith, which is more than 30 years ago. I think you've seen his biographical note. What the note I don't think says is that before his retirement, Ralph was widely known and respected as one of the preeminent thinkers from within the public service about the public service. So it's we have a real national asset here with us today in Ralph as well. So this panel is about basically your chance to hear from them on the Tate Report. So I won't talk too long, but I do want to say a few words about the context for the Tate Report as I see it, in terms of some of the things that were happening in the public service when the report came out. So if we think back for a minute to 1995, when the Tate Task Force and the report were commissioned, just before that, in 1993, June 1993, there was a massive reorganization of the public service, one in which I played a role. That change affected more than half of all the people in the public service and nearly half of all of the departments and agencies. It was a big upheaval. People's lives and careers were thrown up into the air. There was a general sense that the old order, the old established order of the public service had changed, but there was no shared understanding of what the new world looked like. And then fairly shortly thereafter, a year or so later, came program review, which was a cost-cutting deficit reduction exercise that resulted in the departure of more than 50,000 public servants from the government. So that was another big change. So in that context, people were asking, and this was a fair question at the time, what was the public service? What did it stand for? What did it mean to be a public servant? Those are the questions that the Tate Task Force took up in its work. The fruits of their consultations and their conclusions and their insights are found in the Tate Report, a document that ever since then has served as a foundation, a strong foundation for understanding the values of the public service and what defines the vocation of the public servant. So for now, what, 25 plus years, 25 years or more, the Tate Report has been that foundation for us. So I'm only gonna say a couple things about the report because Ralph was the vice chair, Judith was a member, and they will talk about it in their respective ways, but just a couple of observations, if I may, about the report. The first thing I would say to you is that the Tate Report is not just about values and ethics in government. It is really a work of philosophy. And at breakfast this morning, some of the people at our table studied philosophy. I studied philosophy. Ralph's a kind of philosopher. It's really about the sort of the broader structure, the metaphysics of Westminster government in Canada, and about the duties of the public servant within our system of Westminster government. So it is really one of the most important pieces of idea work that's been done in the government in the last 25 years, the last 50 years, frankly. It ranks right up there as one of the most important. It's both theory and some very practical guidance, so that's it. When I read the report again before this conference, I was struck by the subtlety and sort of clarity of its discussion of difficult concepts like responsibility, accountability, anonymity. The report reminds us that the values that we may take for granted today in the public service are founded on principles and essential features of government operations that do not receive as much attention as they deserve. So that's one thing I want to say about it. Second, an observation. It is striking, truly striking, that a report written just more 23 years ago makes virtually no reference to the digital universe in which we live today. So, I mean, one of the biggest things about the world today is that we live in a digital, globally connected universe with all of the good and bad things that brings to us. Doesn't talk about that. Yet the report does start on the assumption that the world is changing, and it seems to foresee more changes in the structure and functioning of government than in fact have occurred. That's the another interesting thing. So it looks ahead, but I guess I have to say I don't think it got some of those things, as it turned out, right. For example, there's been no explosion of different new organizational forms to replace the traditional departmental model or the Crown Corporation model, nor has there been any fundamental shift in our understanding of the respective roles of ministers and officials, including the responsibility of officials within our Westminster system to provide loyal professional advice to ministers on both administration and policy. So that's a really important thing. We're in 2018, and in fact, that fundamental principle is still operating, I would say. It was under some stress under the previous administration, but it's been reaffirmed by the present government. The bigger changes, it seems to me, affecting government, and the ones that have actually occurred, are in the environment in which governments operate today. Not so much in government, as in the world in which they operate, the globalized information universe in which we all live. The ways in which governments can reach out directly to citizens, and vice versa. And this came up recently. In election campaigns now, the parties aren't depending on the news media to report on what they're saying. They're saying directly to the voters whatever they want to say. Sometimes it's not true, you know, or sometimes it's a bit questionable. But those are realities of the world we live in. The globalization of commerce, you know, we live in a world in which, you know, things come to us from the whole world. The attitudes of a digital generation of younger public servants who may have a very different sense of their career and their duties than we did when we started, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. Now, that's an interesting question. We might want to discuss that today. So what I would say to you is that the Tate Report is not a crystal ball, or wasn't a crystal ball. I read it as almost a, quote, biblical text for the public service. It's a repository of more or less permanent truths about the duties of the public servant and the values that should guide them in doing their duty today and in the future. So I'm a huge fan of the Tate Report. I think there is much to be learned from it today in reading it and rereading it. And I think we can learn a lot from two people who were closely involved in its creation, Ralph Heintzman and Judith Moses. I'm going to turn first to Ralph to talk about the report, and then after that we'll turn to Judith to talk about the report in the context, particularly of a provincial government in which she has also worked and knows. So, Ralph, can I start with you?
Well, Bob's getting things going. Maybe I can start by just, first of all, saying to him and to Stephen and to all of the other people who had any role in conceiving and organizing this, what a good idea I think it is to do a retrospective conference on the Tate Report 22 years on. I think, in fact, it's extremely timely, given where the public service is. The title that they've chosen may indeed even be more apt than they thought, which is something I'd like to come back to at the end of my remarks. Like Jim, I'd also like to say what a pleasure it is to be reunited with many of life's companions, including my two colleagues on this panel, but there are many other faces in this room. Who are people that I've worked shoulder to shoulder with on this file and on others over the years. So that's a great pleasure. I want to start today by reminding you where the Tate Report came from, what question it was supposed to answer, and then I'd like to say something about how it worked, what it said, and what its continuing relevance may be for us in the world today and in the public sector. Which is the part that I pressed? There we are. Beautiful. Got it wrong. The Tate Report isn't what many people thought it was at the time, or what it may indeed appear looking back. The watershed of the sponsorship scandal, the Gomery Commission, and the Federal Accountability Act have completely altered the climate and atmosphere in which the public service operates today. And that change of climate means we're living in a world that is radically different in a sense, in, at least in that sense, from the world of the 1980s and the 1990s. And it makes it difficult to recall the atmosphere and the challenges of that earlier period, some of which Jim referred to. It obscures the period since the sponsorship scandal, obscures the question to which the Tate Report was intended to be a partial answer. So it's worth reflecting on the differences between the world we live in post-2000 and the world we lived in pre-2000, because not only does that affect our understanding of the Tate Report, they reflect, I think, two different ways of approaching the moral challenge of public service. And in, I could go further, and I'll come back to this at the end of my remarks, they actually reflect two different currents in Western moral thought. And I think it's important for us to be aware of those two because they relate and interact with each other. I can begin to shed some light on those differences between the two perspectives by recalling where the Tate Task Force came from. What came to be known as the Deputy Minister Task Force on Public Service Values and Ethics actually began its life as a CCMD study team on that topic, sponsored by the research group at what was then called the Canadian Centre for Management Development, now the Canada School of Public Service. Why a CCMD study team? Well, there's a very long answer to that question, but the short answer is concern about the direction of public administration, particularly resulting from the soaring prestige of the private sector since the end of the 1970s. At the beginning of the 1990s, that perspective was beginning to infect the federal public service in a number of ways, reinforced by some of the crises that Jim alluded to. And between the two, between this, the background of the soaring prestige of private sector ways of thinking and some of those pressures on the public service, together they were raising questions about accountability and responsibility, questions about the public service deal. What did it mean to, what was the deal between the public service and its masters? Questions about the public service employment contract, and questions about the fundamentals of public administration in a parliamentary democracy. By exploring those problems, we at CCMD hope to provide a base from which the intellectual confusion surrounding those issues could be abated and the public service could move forward more soundly with confidence in its mission and its identity. So the focus of a Strong Foundation was institutional even more than individual. The task force focused not just on the ethics, but even more on the ethos or underlying spirit or identity of the public service. It was existential in its approach, even more than ethical. There was no ethical crisis, surprisingly, in the public service in the 1980s and 1990s, but there was an existential crisis. There was an identity crisis. And unless public servants became aware of the implications of some of the new concepts and language which were swirling around them in their world, the Tate Report warned, public servants could be drawn unawares into a new set of assumptions about public service, a new set of norms, a new universe of values that are at odds with some of the fundamental requirements of democratic government. So, as Jim said, the key questions at the origin of the Tate Task Force were, what is public administration and public management? What's a public service? What's it for? What is a public servant? Who are we? Because it started from problems like these and premises like these, the Tate's report was the Tate Task Force's approach was inductive rather than deductive. It didn't come up with as had been the pattern in many of the values and ethics exercised before that. It didn't come up with a list or statement of public service values like a code and then apply these a priori to concrete situations and problems. It turned that approach completely around. Instead of starting with the values, it started with the problems of public administration. And it derived what it had to say about values from the problems. And it called this approach, this problem-based approach, if you like, honest dialogue. And in John's mind, certainly, that kind of honest dialogue about real problems was intended not just to talk about public service values, but to model them. Not just discuss them, but show them in action, and in particular, the value of speaking truth to power, one of the themes in the report which caught a lot of public service attention at that time. Jocelyne Bourgon, later clerk of the Privy Council, well, actually clerk of the Privy Council at that time, later said that this quality of honest dialogue about real problems gives the Tate Report, and I quote, a quality of authenticity that could not have been achieved in any other way. The Tate Report rings true to public servants everywhere, and as a result, its four families of values are not cliches, but rather living truths. What the Tate Report did was explore five problems, the five that are listed on this slide, and I'm going to say just a few words about each of them. The first problem was the problem, as Jim already alluded to, the problem of accountability and responsibility. The task force found that many public servants were anxious. They were nervous about the alterations they sensed might be occurring to the traditional anonymity of public servants, and they were uncertain about the accountability dimensions and requirements of some of the new organizational forms that were emerging in the public service at that time and threatened to emerge even further, and we came very close to the agentsification of the Public Service of Canada, prevented only by one vote at the Treasury Board. So here, much of the work of the task force was given to the clarification of the concept and practice of accountability in the public service, especially, as Jim said, the concepts of responsibility, accountability, and answerability, and their mutual relationship, which in a nutshell is the relationship of the dolls in a Russian doll. These clarifications were intended to reassure public servants about the continuity and the adaptability of these traditional fundamental aspects of public service in a parliamentary democracy. And as Jim mentioned, they are still part of our theory of government and democracy and public administration today. The second problem the Tate Task Force was the problem of employment and values. We found that many public servants were concerned about downsizing in the public service and wanted to know whether downsizing had put an end to the concept of a career or professional public service. Here, what the Tate Report did was confirm the continuing relevance of a professional, nonpartisan public service. It also reemphasized some fundamental features of that, including unity and mobility, the merit principle, what it called the values of loyalty. It stated that the core dimension of the traditional public service security of tenure was not, as many people assumed, an ironclad guarantee of lifetime employment, but rather the principle of a professional, nonpartisan public service. But the Tate Report also criticized the then trendy concept of mere employability, here today, gone tomorrow, and emphasized the importance of the length of career experience for a professional public service. It also emphasized the importance of a public service culture and the role of critical mass in maintaining that kind of culture. The third problem that the task force explored was the tension that was then being felt, and I think is still felt in many ways, between what was called old and new values. That involved exploring some of views of the what is called new public management, strongly influenced by private sector management, including total quality management, and its relationship to the old public administration. The tensions between, for example, prudence and probity on the one hand and entrepreneurial risk-taking on the other. The tension between an emphasis on process, and especially due process, and an emphasis on results and outcomes. The Tate Report's verdict on these and many other tensions was that they're real, but they're dynamic rather than destructive, a reflection of the broader and necessary conflict between values themselves. What those tensions were reflecting were actually different values that were in a dynamic and fruitful tension. And seeing them that way lays the groundwork for, as the Tate Report said, a necessary synthesis. The Tate Report also explored the problem of some new ethical challenges which public servants were beginning to express concern about, particularly the potential for subtle new forms of conflict of interest arising from some of the new forms of management I just referred to. They weren't sure that they had the tools or the frameworks to make these things work in a manner consistent with sound public service values. The Tate Report's verdict on that was that the principles were basically sound, especially the principles of things in the area of conflict of interest. But they needed much better support in the public service, certainly through training and orientation, but also better leadership, both from the Treasury Board Secretariat and from departments. As part of what the Tate Report called a comprehensive ethics regime. In passing, I'll just mention that in this chapter, the Tate Report also reaffirmed the importance of rules and laws. One of the things that people sometimes assume is that values can replace rules and laws, that we can operate without the one because we have the other. And one of the things the Tate Report said very firmly is that having and obeying rules and laws is one of the values of public service, something that's worth remembering. The fifth problem that the task force looked at was the problem of leadership and people management in the public service. And I think this is one of the most important parts of the Tate Report. I recommend it to you for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I think that it has not received the full attention that it deserves. What the Tate Task Force found was that many public servants told them that they had the feeling of a kind of fault line, what they called a fault line, or we called a fault line in the public service, a kind of divide between the top several ranks of the public service and the rest. And ordinary public servants said they weren't sure that the people above them had the same kinds of values or manifested the same kinds of values as they did. And the way they put that, which is still a language we hear today, they weren't sure that the people up there actually walked the talk. Oh, thank you very much, Bob. I'm getting too excited here. No. There we are. Perfect. Thank you. Please interrupt if I do something like that again. For that reason, the Tate Report put a lot of emphasis on the role and importance of leadership in a public service. It recommended that deputy ministers and other public service leaders should be selected, evaluated, and promoted on their demonstrated and measured ability to lead and manage people in a positive, productive way, their ability to create good workplaces, and their ability to model and nourish public service values. In order to make the accountability real, the Tate Report recommended it should be based on solid, quantitative measures of leadership skills derived from things like organizational climate surveys, feedback instruments, and other instruments of that kind, which should be used routinely. The Tate Report said, at the top of the public service to ensure accountability. And in an important sentence, which I'd like to read, the Tate Report said, in the long run, no other single factor is likely to have more impact on the quality and condition of public service values. In addition to our running through its discussion of those five problems, the Tate Report had some consistent themes, kind of horizontal themes or threads that run through the whole report. I'm not going to touch on those now because of time, but I'd be delighted to come back and talk about any of them if you're interested, because in many ways these horizontal themes are some of the most interesting things about the Tate Report, particularly things like the democratic mission of the public service and the theme of the public interest. The most famous and in some sense enduring aspect of the Tate Report, of course, is its discovery or articulation at the end of the report after and through its exploration of those five problems of four families of public service values. I think the first time, certainly in the federal public service and maybe in any other Canadian public service, that something like this had been attempted, an articulation of the architecture, if you like, of public service values. These are pretty well known now, so I don't need to dwell on the democratic values, professional values, ethical values, and people values. But I'd love to talk about them if you'd like to do that in the discussion period. The Tate Report deliberately contained no formal recommendations, and that was a deliberate choice by John and the task force because they didn't want to make it easy. If there's a checklist at the end of the report, that's all anybody looks at. John was very keen that people work their way through the problems and actually do the think work themselves. But if you go in and look carefully, you'll find something like 35 specific recommendations and another approximately 33 general recommendations. Some of these have been implemented since the Tate Report. I think, for example, of the disclosure regime that we now have through the Public Service Disclosure and Protection Act. Some have been partially implemented. For example, the measurement of the workplace through the Public Service Employee Survey. Some have been implemented in forms other than the Tate Report recommended, such as the current Code of Values and Ethics. Some have been implemented and then de-implemented. For example, Treasury Board Secretariat's role in this area. Some have not been implemented at all. For example, the Tate's centerpiece recommendation for a parliamentary initiative, a statement of public service principles that would form a new moral contract between Parliament, ministers, and the public service. There was a commitment to do that in the Public Servants Disclosure Protection Act, but it has never been moved on. And some of the recommendations, it's not easy to judge the degree of implementation. For example, the degree to which deputy ministers are now evaluated in the way the Tate Report recommended. So after the Tate Report, that brings me back to the difference between the 2000 and the pre-2000 period. After 2000, many of the recommendations of the Tate Report were put in place in the way that I just described. We now have many of the pieces of what it called an ethics regime through the Values and Ethics Code, through the PSDPA, through the Federal Accountability Act. Mary's office is part of a broad ethics regime for the public sector. Yet, that same period, in my view, witnessed some of the lowest points in recent history for public service values. And the whole concept of a professional, nonpartisan public service. There was, first of all, and this was something we didn't see coming, the sponsorship scandal with its spectacle of public service wrongdoing at the highest level, but also in that lamented scandal, the failure of a deputy minister to exercise his public service duties properly and even more gravely, the collusion of the Privy Council Office in preventing him from doing so, well documented by the Gomery Commission. Following the sponsorship scandal, we had three successive clerks of the Privy Council who turned the Privy Council Office into an operational communications command post for partisan political messaging, propaganda, and political marketing. The clerk himself, in a variety of ways, publicly crossed the line between nonpartisan and partisan language and behavior. And the clerks and PCO's example were picked up by DMs and ADMs in a variety of ways that I don't need to go into at this point. So in my view, the period since 2000 has been, in a way, the best of times for public service values and ethics, and, as Charles Dickens would say, the worst of times. The post-2000 emphasis in the public service has been on ethics, on rules, on compliance, on wrongdoing, on individual ethical dilemmas and decisions, and on moral reasoning. The pre-2000 focus of the Tate Report was on values. What's a public service? What's it for? Who are we and who do we want to be? Existential questions of identity, purpose, and goals. Did begin, didn't I? As it happens, and this is my conclusion, this reflects two fundamentally different approaches to the moral life. The first is the question, what's the right thing to do? That's the question of Immanuel Kant, of Jeremy Bentham, of John Stuart Mill, and of most modern ethics. It's the ethical question, or the ethics question. But there's another question, which is an older question, a question that goes back to Aristotle, what's the right thing to be? And I think the experience of the public service since 2000 confirms that the second question is prior to the first. To be ethical is not just a matter of knowing the rules of the game. It's being committed enough to that game to care how it turns out. If you don't know what's the right thing to be, chances are you won't recognize that there's an ethical dilemma in the first place. Your gut won't pay attention. You won't know that you're about to cross a line that you shouldn't cross, so you won't even be able to apply moral reasoning to it. You won't even get to that question. And if you do, you won't care very much about the answer to that question. In order to be ethical, you have to be already leading and striving to lead a certain kind of life. Ethical life isn't really made up of isolated individual reasoning processes and decisions, as anthropologist Webb Keane says in a wonderful new book. It's not just a matter of knowing the rules of the game, something any idle bystander might accomplish as well. It's being committed enough to that game to care how it turns out. To be ethical, Webb Keane says, is to be invested in a way of life and to live up to some vision of what a good person ought to be, or we could say, what a good public servant ought to be. The Tate Report was focused on defining and explaining what a good public servant ought to be. It sought to articulate that vision in a way that would be sufficiently compelling that public servants might want to invest themselves in it and seek to live up to it. And I think that if the federal public service is going to recover some of the ethical ground lost since 2000, it needs to return to that kind of motivating vision of the values of a professional, nonpartisan public service in a parliamentary democracy. But for that kind of vision to ring true, and I'm quoting Jocelyn there, like the Tate Report, it has to be based on truth-telling and acknowledging real problems and errors. As far as I know, no one in the public service has yet acknowledged or taken responsibility for how the public service and the Privy Council Office crossed the line and departed from public service values in the period after 2000. And until they do, I'm not sure that any inspiring vision of the public service will really ring true to ordinary public servants. Nonetheless, in order to give you a little flavor of the vision and values in which public servants could invest themselves and seek to live up to in their real lives, let me leave you with the concluding, or some of the concluding words of the Tate Report, which I've heard read in many circumstances now, including what was very moving at one funeral of a senior public servant. I won't read them to you, but I'll leave them for you to remember the spirit and the vision of the Tate Report.
So, colleagues, first of all, didn't I tell you Ralph is a philosopher, and I would urge all of you to reflect on what he has just said. I'm going to exercise a bit of chairman's prerogative here. Because I have to leave in a couple of minutes, I am going to ask a question of Ralph, and then leave him to answer it for you. And I'll catch up with him on his answer over lunch or something like that. And then just a couple of things. Then after that, we will turn to Judith, and she will have the floor at the podium, and you can ask her and Ralph all the questions you wish. But the question I would like to put to Ralph right now, on our collective behalf, Ralph, was there anything that the Tate Report missed? I mean, was there a big thing that, in retrospect, looking back 22 years later, you think, gosh, we should have talked about X, and we didn't. So that's my question to you. Take a few minutes to answer it if you wish, and then following that, Judith, I'll invite you to take the podium. Colleagues, I'm sorry I have to leave you at this point. I've been force measured over at Rideau Hall, but I do congratulate Bob and the organizers of the conference, and I again urge you to reflect on what Ralph has put to you. This is not a propaganda show today, as you can see. You heard from Ralph some very straight goods, and I invite you to reflect on that. So, Ralph, the question is, what did the Tate Report overlook? What did it not address that it should have? There you go.
Well, I don't want to take up too much time right now, but I think the Tate Report actually missed quite a few things. I think that most of what it talked about, it got more or less right, although that's probably a debatable proposition. But I think it missed some really big stuff that was starting to emerge at that time and that we ought to have seen. The biggest one, I think, was the whole area of communications, as I just alluded to. If looking back, you can see that was beginning to emerge. We didn't see it. We didn't see that communications is one of the real flashpoints. Oh, thank you. For the relationship between public servants and ministers, I think we ought to have had a chapter on that. I think we missed a lot of other things, too. We didn't see the emergence of what has since been called the new political governance, that is to say, the way in which, and this is relates to the communications theme, the way in which the new communications technology was concentrating political leadership and changing the political game in ways that were going to affect public administration. We didn't see, I think, the emergence of court government, what Donald Savoy has since called court government, which is something that infects the public service as much as the political level. And in that context, I don't think, I know we didn't, but we should have addressed much more directly the role of the clerk of the Privy Council, and particularly the role of the clerk in the appointment of deputy ministers and the way in which that reinforces or rather inhibits speaking truth to power in the public service. There are a bunch of other things, but I'll leave it at that for the moment so we can get on to Judith.
Bonjour. Merci d'avoir l'occasion d'être ici ce matin. I'd like to take a bit more of a practitioner's approach to my presentation. Before I do that, I just would like to acknowledge the elder this morning and the Seven Grandfather Teachings. I'm from Six Nations myself. I had never made the connection between the Grandfather Teachings and my passion for public service values and ethics, and I thank you for reminding me that that there are some roots to who we are. So From my perspective, I was in the old human resources department at the time, and I was busy building new government, industry, labor, education partnerships following on from the free trade agreement. So my participation in the Tate Task Force was, bringing that kind of perspective. I had also spent 5 years at Machinery of Government with Jim Mitchell, and was very familiar with the basics in terms of the guidance from ministers about the democratic process, etc. So I have to say that, as both Ralph and Jim alluded to, the crisis of the day for me as a director general was downsizing. It was the preoccupation of employees of the public service that they might lose their jobs. It is very difficult to inspire and to lead people working under those conditions. So what I found as a public service leader at the time was the overwhelming need for a rudder to help to see our way through this. Because I was involved in the Tate Task Force, I had that insight and that inspiration. But at the time, leaders in the public service did not have this common set of values as a shared leadership tool. We were not sending out consistent messaging to employees across the public service. We did not have the kinds of institutional guideposts that Ralph had mentioned. You know, what are those values? How are they expressed? How did they evolve? How did we get here? So the answers were not easy to come by, and frankly, we were making it up as we went along. So that was one of the big concerns that I had, and brought that kind of practical insight to the task force. What we needed, and what Tate, I think, provided us, was what requirements would an ethics regime need in order to make this work? And he talked, as Ralph said, about the need for this code or the statement of principles that had to supplement what departments already had, because we weren't starting from ground zero. There were embedded values and principles and ethics at the time. They just were not as clearly articulated, and there wasn't a system-wide approach to try to articulate them. And then, of course, the counseling and the recourse mechanisms for people who are struggling with ethical challenges. So those were some of the things that we needed to focus on. Sorry, I'm having a little trouble with this. There we go. One of the things that I found that I really did need was more support in the whole area of democratic values and the people values. I went to work for the Public Service Commission, where Mary Gazzella was one of the commissioners at that time, and we faced a massive downsizing. I had to let 300 people go, and I can't tell you how horrible that was. And so what I was faced with was, how do I take these values that we were talking about in the Tate Task Force and apply them to the real world? And of course, the Public Service Commission was the guardian of the merit principle, so that went without saying that we had to do something there. And we did what we called a reverse order of merit process. As an organization, we felt we had to lead the public service in how do you go about doing downsizing. In terms of the people values, there were a few things that I tried to do. One of them was, we rented the City Hall in Hull, and we had a celebration for the people who were leaving, presented them with long service medals and awards, and their families were invited, their children were there. So we were very conscious of trying to treat people with respect. The whole communications part, the meetings with the unions. We set up an anonymous employee email site so that people who had suggestions could get in touch with us. And one of the key things that I did was hire a labor relations consultant from Carleton University who literally followed me around for a year and documented everything that we went through, wrote up a case study on what to do and what not to do. So that was my own personal way of trying to come to grips with some of the challenges that we were articulating at another level in the Tate Task Force. I want to move on from federal. I did go to work in the Cabinet Office in the Ontario Public Service around 2003 and led a central agency review there, and had an opportunity to migrate some of our thinking to the Ontario Public Service. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but just to say that part of the massive restructuring there was the opportunity to update their Public Service Act legislation. There was an opportunity to update it, to bring together various pieces of legislation that were either non-existent or in different places. The whistleblowing legislation was on the books but hadn't yet been enacted. And following on from that, there was later developed a guide for public service ethics and conduct. And the focus was, of course, in Ontario, the main difference was on service to the public. They delivered service. 530 agencies of government there. And so a lot of the service delivery was not inside of the core of government. So it was very important to recognize that was one of the main differences that I found between Ottawa and Ontario. So we did have an opportunity to, I think, get out in front in Ontario on a new Public Service of Ontario Act. I have to say that they did not go through the kind of soul searching that we went through in Ottawa in developing that act. It was very top down. It was early in the administration's life, the McGuinty government, and there was a window of opportunity there to move quickly because politicians generally are not interested in this kind of legislation. So it was put through fairly quickly and within months of my recommendation to do this. The act itself, the purposes I had suggested and was hoping that we could have a more embedded code than we had at the federal level. And what we ended up doing was describing values and ethics, I think, in the introduction to the act in the purposes section. And I think we covered a lot of the basics there in terms of being effective to serve government, the public and legislature, the whole notion of a nonpartisan, professional, ethical, competent public service. They did not have an independent public service commission. The Civil Service Commission was right inside of the Cabinet Office, effectively. It still isn't as independent as the federal one. It reports to the head of the public service and not to Parliament. The roles and responsibilities were set out very clearly in the OPS legislation and the framework for leadership and management. The roles were described in ways that they still are not described federally. The rights and duties of public servants about ethical conduct and political activity, and of course the procedures for disclosure and wrongdoing and protection from reprisals was also included. The following on from that, there was a code of ethics and conduct, a guide they called it there, and the mission was to serve the public interest and uphold the public trust. And the mission that was set out for the Ontario Public Service was to support the elected government with honest, impartial, objective advice, carry out decisions and policy, and administer to highest professional standards, to conduct oneself with integrity, and the stewardship of public resources. Not that that isn't important federally, of course it is. It is of preeminent importance at the provincial level because of the size of the services that they and scope that they deliver. And of course, fulfilling duties in accordance with law and public service oaths and being accountable for how roles are fulfilled. The federal democratic values were expressed as principles to maintain public trust at the provincial level, focused on ethical behavior, the prudent and lawful use of resources, picking up on Ralph's point that laws and rules are important, as important with values and ethics, and they have to be balanced. Value for money and quality service, huge, huge issues in the Ontario Public Service. While I was there, they introduced a money-back guarantee for service, for example, for driver's licenses and birth certificates and that sort of thing. So that was really much more the focus there. Fairness and equity and openness and transparency. And that's what I've got up there basically shows how those principles stack up against the Tate Task Force democratic values. And again, I won't go through the details of these, but just to say that the OPS values mainly fall under the Tate category of professional values. The values of fairness, excellence, creativity, collaboration, efficiency, responsiveness. The trust stacks up with a Tate ethical side and diversity on the people's side. So while there wasn't an exact replica of the values expressed in Ontario, I think it's fair to say that the Tate Task Force, in terms of my representation there, and I organized a number of sessions with heads of public services across the country. We had the Brits in, we had the Australians in. I think the Tate Task Force was instrumental in providing a basis for conversation across the country. People here would not necessarily have known that. There were a number of people from Ottawa who were involved with Tony Dean, the head of the public service at that time. So partly an answer to the question, is it still relevant? It's still relevant in the sense that it's embedded across the country. Do people look at that and say, ah, yes, the origin of that was the Tate Task Force? No, they do not. But I think people who were involved, engaged in those issues at the time were very much aware of the importance and the foundational value of this. So it's in there. I'd like to also make a point about the fact that values evolve. And I came across this, I didn't know this myself until recently, but the Ontario Oath of Office was amended not very long ago. And it talked about, I will respect the laws of Canada, including the recognition and affirmation of Aboriginal and treaty rights of Indigenous peoples in the Constitution. I found that quite breathtakingly progressive. And it is a lot easier. We were talking last night, some of my colleagues on the panel today, about how much easier it is to make change at the provincial level. And it is true, that was certainly my experience there. But it does show that when the question was asked, were there things we overlooked? We were certainly aware of diversity in the public service, and we talked a lot about it. But we didn't spend a lot of time on the charter and the effects that that would have eventually on the composition of the public service. So I just leave that with you as an example of how values do evolve, and that these values, while they were representative at the time and they by and large apply today, they will continue to evolve over time. And I think I'd like to stop there. I had a number of other examples which I could save for the question and answer period.
Thank you very much, Judith. Judith asked if these slides will be made available. I'm going to ask each of the five presenters who are using slides afterwards whether they would approve of us simply distributing them to all registrants, because we have the emails of everybody who registered, and that would be a simple way to do it. And then besides broader use via a website later, that would be a separate question. We have just over 15 minutes, and I'd like to invite people to come to one of the two microphones to pose a question. They have to be turned on. Mark, there's a button on the top, and if you press on it for... Oh, our technician Mario is coming to help. No. There.
Thank you.
Once the green light is on. And we are... this is Mario with St. Paul's, who's helping us out today. And the proceedings are being recorded. If you don't want your question recorded, please just say so, if you don't want to be part of a recording.
Mark Godson, I'm a retired public servant. I'd like to bring out what I consider to be the elephant in the room. I find it very difficult to hear about ethics and leadership when we're dealing with a government that doesn't pay its people. We're dealing with a government that, after 2 years, can't arrange to pay the majority of its people. The enthusiasm of this government to solve the problem is pathetic. So I think that really needs to be addressed, because there is no leadership. In the absence of leadership, why are we talking about ethics in this public service?
I'm not going to prevent our panelists from answering, but I will point out that the first panel this afternoon takes us into the present, and I think those panelists are forewarned, and they may not show up after lunch knowing what you want to ask. Do either of you want to answer that?
I would, this is not a moment of triumph for the public service in the management of major projects. But I don't think that when any institution, whether it's a public service or another, has, as it were, a failure in some particular aspect of its work or its competence, that calls into question the entire structure and purpose and raison d'etre of that institution. It's a challenge and a problem that needs to be dealt with, and presumably it needs to be dealt with using and, to the extent possible, embodying the very values and principles of the institution. I mean, yes, obviously, the failure on the pay system is a great blow to the professional pride and professional values of the public service. It's a very complicated story, as I'm sure you know. There are many people responsible for that problem. And the public service is not the only institution in the world, either in any sector, that has struggled with these kinds of problems. But I don't think that when you run into that kind of major roadblock, setback, failure, that calls into question the fundamental values and raison d'etre of the institution, which I think then need to be called forth to address the issue.
I think public service always has to be aware of reputational damage, whether it's within or outside. And I think the administrative part of government is as important as the institutional basics of government. And I'm not familiar with this. I mean, I've read about it in the Globe and Mail, but I guess I would have to second Ralph's views about project management. Every organization in the world makes these kinds of mistakes. Sometimes, for example, in the case of, I don't know, Tylenol, they may never recover, or depending on how they respond to it, they may recover lost ground. But clearly, the issue of confidence and trust of employees in their political masters, in this case, is very, very important.
Thank you. Robert?
Yeah, Robert Gariepi, working in Indian Affairs. I have two questions of understanding. The first is to know more about possible inspiration Mr. Tate would have used in developing his report. Did he have in mind similar reports made in the U.S. or in the Europe, or was it really made out of, you know, internal in Canada, or was there, you know, other thinkers like him? Anyway, I think you got the gist of my question. My second question is about a bullet in your presentation, just saying managing up, managing down, and I was left with not really understanding what you meant.
On the first question, I don't think, I'm trying to think, I don't actually think we had any models or inspirations for what we did. Part of the long explanation that I didn't go into about the origins of the Tate Task Force was that the so-called study team was an example of what I pretentiously called at that time action research. And one of the things that I was trying to encourage and create at CCMD was research not just about the public service, but research that involved the public service in the research and in the application. And the study team was just a way of doing that, of bringing the public service into reflecting on its own identity and issues and direction. There are some other wonderful examples I'd love to boast about, but so that was one of the inspirations, was a methodological inspiration, if you like. From a substantive point of view, one of the advantages that we had was that we deliberately involved in the task force a non-public servant, Ken Kernahan, who was at that time the leading Canadian academic in the field of public administration generally, but specifically public service ethics and values. So it was a great help to have Ken as part of our, an actual member of the task force, who then brought to bear all of his own research and reading and bibliography. In fact, the expression ethics regime, which appears in the Tate report, comes directly from Ken's own writing. If you were to read some of Ken's stuff, you'd find that term ethics regime sprinkled through it, and that was one of the ways in which it came into the task force thinking.
Yes, we were focused inside. We weren't unaware of what was going on. I mean, Ken was wonderful in terms of bringing that insight. But about the same time that the Tate Task Force report came out, the UK, around the same time, came out with their 7 principles of public life. They were going through a lot of the same things that we were going through. We did not have a lot of dynamic conversation. We were certainly aware of what they were doing, but you know, they came up with selflessness, integrity, objectivity, accountability, openness, honesty, leadership. So they took all of our extensive work in a report and reduced it to 7 bullets. I'm not saying that I mean, it obviously there was a lot of context to it, but John Tate, as Ralph pointed out before, we deliberately did not come up with a list because we wanted people to read the report, understand the principles behind the values, and so we took a totally different approach than how the Brits did.
Before I ask our panelists to go to managing up, managing down, est-ce qu'il y a une expression en français qui dit exactement la même chose? Does anybody know of an equivalent French expression? Because that would then solve the problem.
Gestion vers la haut versus gestion vers le bas.
Yeah, well, that doesn't quite get across. Paying attention to what the bosses want versus paying attention to what's going on in your team and so forth? Something like that?
Well, that's pretty simple. I mean, the traditional orientation of a public service in parliamentary democracy is upwards toward the minister and towards parliament. And in that kind of state of mind, you can often forget about what's down below you and is supporting you. You're looking up, you're trying to not just please, but actually serve the people above you and serve their duty of accountability to Parliament. One of the good things that the new public management brought to public service, and I should say, and the report says, one of the good things that private sector examples brought to the public service was more of an emphasis on managing down and out, being aware that you had people that you were responsible for, you had citizens that you were serving, absorbing of that insight in the 1980s and 1990s in some people's mind was a difficult transition because it seemed to be in tension with their traditional responsibility towards the minister and towards parliament. People began to play around with terms like upward and downward accountability in those times, terms which I think are actually quite fruitful and worth thinking about.
In terms of some of the actual challenges that people were facing at that time, and not people certainly have gone through this since, but there were many managers who were asked to dismantle and deep six programs that they perhaps spent a lifetime building. That was a real test of loyalty and commitment and upward management of serving the minister and the democratic process that put that minister there. So the managing down part of that was, how do you then take people who are so committed to what they're doing and tell them that we're going to unwind this program and you're probably going to go with it? That was an unbelievably difficult challenge.
I'm glad that Judith added that, because that's actually a really important point that my comments might have overlooked. That is to say, one of the things that John himself was particularly concerned about was that at a time of downsizing and other activities like that, some public servants were so attached to what they were doing and so convinced about the worth of what they were doing that they found it very difficult to carry out, a political or ministerial decision that the government was going to move out of that area. And that created a real tension between their sense of the worth of what they were doing and the value of their democratic accountability to the government and the minister. They experienced a real tension. And in that case, it was the reverse of what I was talking about before.
One example from Ontario a few years ago, when the federal government made some huge cuts to science research, it affected a lot of the Ontario science-based operations, and it got so bad in terms of public servants resisting the changes that the deputy minister asked the Institute on Governance, where I was at the time, to pull together a program, and we literally had to sit these people down, and the deputy came in and read the Riot Act. He said, get with the program or get out. And you know, it was a horrible way to have to say that, but that was the bottom line at the time. They had to turn their attention to implementing the changes that were decided at the political level.
Thank you, Robert, for your questions. Mary?
Well, this is a wonderful time to reflect. And as I reflect over my public service career, I would say that values and ethics were mostly in the early years absorbed kind of like through osmosis and until, of course, the report came out. In contrast, I've worked a little bit in the Ontario government, where there's a very vigorous program of bringing together even people who are on outside boards and agencies and training them in values and ethics. It's not a lengthy training, but it's a very in-depth one. And I guess I would ask you both to reflect on whether you think that the immediate follow-up to the publication of the Tate report, how you assess and how satisfied are you with the immediate follow-up? I know, Ralph, you talked about what happened in the 2000s and beyond. Would a more vigorous follow-up or a more formal approach to training people or causing them to take into account ethics, would it have perhaps inoculated against some of the activities that came about in the year 2000? Just your rough assessment.
I don't think the follow-up to the report was as vigorous as perhaps John might have liked. one of the central recommendations of the report was for deputy ministers to lead in their departments exactly to replicate exactly the same kind of dialogue which we had had the privilege of having in and I the glass is neither half full nor half empty, it's both. I think some of that did occur, and indeed not only under John's leadership but under his successor leadership as champion, under Scott and Janice's leadership, a good deal of that did occur. I think, you know, there could have been more of it, and there could have been a more thorough approach. One of the risks, Mary, is that when things become routinized into training and orientation, they risk going back to that very situation which the Tate report diagnosed as having preceded them, i.e., something that's just a formality, it's just on a wall, and I get over it, and then I get on with my real life. And I think, you know, a fair amount of the work of the Tate Task Force has gone back to that state. I talked to a public servant the other day who, a new public servant who was being oriented, and now there is a values and ethics orientation required. In fact, you have to go online and you have to pass. But for them, this was just a kind of rote routine. They weren't paying much attention to it. They wanted to get it over it as quickly as possible. And the whole juice, if you like, the whole meaning, the whole purpose of it, I think completely passed over their heads. So how you institutionalize it and yet keep it alive and vigorous and vivacious, I'm not sure. I personally agree with the Tate report, is that the best way is the very informal way that you were talking about. The very best way we learn is from other people. It's from role models and examples. It's from working for a Mary Gazella or a Scott Searson and absorbing their way of being in the world.
The code itself came out in 2003, which is a few years after the report itself. So could it have happened, you know, in a more expeditious way? Probably. It could have. But I have to agree with Ralph. To push it faster than the institution believed it would not have served the purpose that John foresaw, so that it did not become rote, it wasn't imposed, that it was internalized and believable. It probably took that long to do that. The thing that I think could have been done better, perhaps in the aftermath of the report, was to actually codify and develop some of those examples, because again, I endorse what Ralph said, the examples speak louder than words in terms of people grasping what it is. And my experience is you can understand all of this, but even role-playing, until you're faced with that ethical dilemma that you know the answer to, but what do you actually say and do when confronted with it? That was some of the big challenge. So I don't know to what extent that kind of support exists now, but it did not exist at that time. My Ontario situation, because it was more top down, I was invited back in 2 years after my central agency review report to do an assessment of how they were doing in implementing the recommendations. And one thing that I found is that the new Ontario Public Service Act was still theoretical. It was not being used actively as a change management tool. They were working on it, but they weren't using it as a basis to galvanize support and loyalty, et cetera, to the institution by using it. They had a tool, and they just were not using it at that. I think it happened later, but within 2 years after, it was still theoretical.
Thank you. We were supposed to have ended this session at 15:15. There are already two other people who have questions. I think it's very important that we continue for just a few more minutes, but I'd ask both of you to keep your questions short. And I think the culprits in terms of time management are not the people standing. So, and then we'll adjust the return time just a little bit. So, over here.
Hi, my name's Theodol. I'm a doctoral student at the Ethics and Public Affairs Program at Carleton. I'm also a Department of Justice lawyer. I've had 25 years in the public service. One comment, there are structures currently, Department of Justice, you know, those courses help because you are able to identify when you have an issue, and we have an excellent values and ethics office, which we consult with to get advice. So those structures, I think, are very important.
Excellent.
And in fact, more important than simply being able to identify those rare models, role models, because they don't exist everywhere. Management, I think there's a great management deficit in Department of Justice specifically. And, you know, it's, when you have structures in place that can guide managers and employees, it's very, very useful. I have one more comment and then a question. I'm glad you raised your last slide. My particular area is in how the government at the state responds to Indigenous claims. And I think when we look at the TRC report and the calls to action which have been taken up by civil society, provinces, the federal government, that will require a significant shift in the ethical framework right through to the Constitution. So it's not simply a matter of diversity or management of the brown people or the Indigenous people in this country. It's going to require some significant reworking. Now, my question actually has to do with a business model. The government of Canada, or any government, their purpose is not the same as the purpose that a business has, which is to make profit and to capitalize. It's for the public good. And yet, over the span of my career, I've seen an integration of business models, business values, profit maximization of a sort. Like, they've tried to incorporate those tools. In your opinion, how useful do you think that is? Because I personally have a problem with it.
Sorry, how
useful do you think it
how
is
useful?
To sort of integrate private sector business principles in management of government ethical framework? You know, what we're trying to do. Our purposes are very different. So when you use those tools to sort of get people to function, it can be quite at odds with their public service values. So I'm just interested in your comments.
Ralph, you mentioned the growing prestige of the private sector in the late 70s.
A great question. That was, in fact, I would say, one of the key questions at the heart of the Tate Task Force and the Tate Report. And I don't know whether it's chapter 3 or 4, but I recommend it to you if you haven't read it, because it's a discussion of exactly that question. How do these private sector concepts and language fit, if they fit at all, in a context of public administration, where our job is to support democratic governance and the public interest? In a nutshell, I think the Tate Report's conclusion is that those concepts can be fruitful. They can bring in ideas, concepts, ways of thinking about things which are helpful to the public service, not so much because of their radical newness, but because they can help to revive certain fundamental public service values. And I'm disobeying Bob's injunction here, but one example is the whole question of client-oriented service. There's a long discussion in the Tate Report about this word of client and customer, which I am one of those who've tried to stamp out in the public sector. I started something called an Institute for Citizen-Centered Service, precisely to get citizen into it. But one of the things the Tate Report says is that whole concept of client service helped us to re-examine and relearn the whole idea of service to citizens. We had often thought of ourselves as kind of governing citizens and not always seen that we were there to actually serve them. And so that's just an example of how properly adapted and properly filtered through our values private sector ideas, concepts, language can help to revive public administration.
One of the examples that I've observed is more awareness of the dynamics of innovation and experimentation.
Just another practical example is the Sarbanes-Oxley report in the United States, and the notion of having a chair and a CEO as the same person. I mean, we had lots of instances like that in Canada. And I would argue that the amendments to provincial and federal legislation governing nonprofits took into account the notions of who is your constituency. You have a duty to report to them once a year. Those kinds of things were not part of how a lot of organizations thought. So there are crises like that that do force us to look at ourselves, and I think it's very healthy that we do that.
The very last, very quick question.
Yeah, Stephen Heron, another still a full-time public servant, last 16, 17 years. And I wanted to come back to the question of managing up and managing down again. I think I heard Ralph Heinzman say that Tate emphasized the importance of living the values in the way one managed the people working under one. My perspective is that the quality of management in government is extremely uneven, and there's a greater de facto emphasis on serving the leaders with what they want when they want it than there is on making sure that there aren't really poor management practices downward. So given that you mentioned the intent of public service employee surveys to try and ensure that we know how good of a job leaders are doing, do you see some way in which what I take to be a deficiency in the way public service functions can be fixed? In other words, like, how do we go from managing up to ensuring that we can recruit and retain the best and the brightest by having them work in organizations where they can be assured that they'll have high quality leaders that they can look up to.
Excuse me, Stephen, but don't you expect Mary Dawson in her keynote address to completely solve that issue?
Everybody can have a shot at it.
Well, I'll just one quick answer to that. The federal public service has been relatively lousy compared to some other public services like Ontario, but more particularly British Columbia, in actually using data to identify where we have those lousy managers. The BC not only does a public service employee survey, they can break it down to the smallest work units, well, at least the smallest that you can get to without breaking confidentiality, and they can identify the hotspot, what they call the hotspots. Each one of those places where they've got an example of organizational tyranny or organizational whatever, and we don't do that. And I think the federal public service has been really crummy on that front. And I agree with you. It is a serious problem. The Tate Report identified it as a serious problem, and I frankly think it is a worse problem today than it was then.
Okay, we've got somebody breaking the rules there. Meg?
It's not a question. Thank you very much. I just have an announcement picking up on the fact that there may be some lawyers in the room, and I just wanted to let people know that this today's session has been approved for 3 hours and 5 minutes of professionalism content by the Law Society of Ontario, and specifically this session that we've just had. If you're a lawyer, you can put in for 1 hour and 15 minutes of professionalism content for your.
Thank you very much, Meg. I really don't have time for the administrative points that I was going to make, but there is a Wi-Fi connection with a login and a password. I'll just leave them up on the desk here. It's also at the registration area. So thank you very much to our panelists. I cut you off. Sorry, Judith, at the end there. And to not get too far behind, let's call the half-hour break a 22-minute break and come back at 10 to 11.